I get to be the president. I'm Nick Schweitzer. We don't have our name tags, but Jay Rennie says probably half of the name tags are our Dave anyway.
Yep.
The wheels are in motion.
So I get to introduce
our married fans.
Speaker, and actually we'll have a commentator arriving a little bit later. The two speakers tonight probably need absolutely no introduction for most of you, and I'm tempted to just sit down. Especially any of you who are associated in any way with the literary world. But for the one or two of you who may not know them, I get to introduce them. I'll read a couple of short bios. I'm tempted to also ask for a show of hands for all those who have read columns or books by the one or two of you who have. So I get to first introduce Paul Palin. Paul is president and publisher of the Capital Times. He's a native of Sumter, Illinois. He has a BA in journalism from Drake University, an MA in communication and politics from the American University of Washington, D.C. He was a reporter and editor at the Wisconsin State Journal, and then later vice president of operations for the combined Mass and Newspapers Incorporated before he joined the Cap Times in 2006. As vice president, he oversaw building-wide operations. Currently, he oversees the Cap Times editorial and business operations, writes a weekly column, and chairs the board meetings of the Capital Times Company and the EdU Foundation, the company's charitable arm. That foundation recently gave a very generous gift to the friends here. Later, John Nichols will be joining us. He has another obligation, I guess.
Probably 23 minutes.
Okay. John, many of you know that name, is the associate editor of the Capital Times and the executive editor of The Nation magazine. He's the author or co-author of more than a dozen books on media and democracy, including most recently, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. A New York Times bestseller that he wrote with Senator Bernie Sanders. Native of rural Wisconsin, he has lived, worked, and reported from around the world. Iceland, South Africa during the transition from apartheid, Palestine, numerous African and Southern Asian, Central American, and Caribbean countries. Please welcome.
Thanks a lot. This is such an intimate crowd. I hope you don't mind. I've got a bit of a knee thing going on. Is it okay if I sit? Okay. Thank you. Yeah, John's going to join us in a few minutes. So I'll just tell you kind of where I thought we'd go tonight. I thought I'd talk a little bit about the past, present, and future of Cap Times and newspaper in general, a bit more about my background. And then I want to talk. Nick asked me to talk about the newspaper business generally, and I can talk to that as well. And then my colorful colleague, John Nichols, will be joining us, and we'll talk more about the two newspapers here in Madison and take it from there. And please, feel free to, this is just having a conversation, and if you want to raise a question, that's great. I decided at the last minute to pull out a three-minute video we produced on our 100th anniversary. Now it's almost 10 years ago. Some of the rest of the staff has changed. You'll see me in it and John. John's a little grayer now. I'm wearing the same hairstyle. So this just takes 3 minutes, but it gives you a sense of how we present ourselves to the community.
Steve,
you're
next.
Era of sound bites and alternative facts, it might feel like the truth has never been harder to find. But what it really comes down to is knowing where to look. Thanks to the guiding spirit of William T. Evans, that place has been the Cap Times for more than 100 years. Evans founded the Cap Times in 1970, in the months after the U.S. entered the First World War. Frustrated by attacks against the founder of the Progressive Movement, fighting Bob LaFollin, Evans was determined to create a paper that championed ordinary people and challenged powerful business interests. A paper that spoke out for those whose lives and livelihoods were at the mercy of the power, that would work in partnership with those it served. and foster the progressive spirit, no matter the obstacles, no matter the cause. Over the years, the Cadet Times has stood against racism and extremism and challenged demagogues, opposed to unjust rules around the globe. It spoke out when ideals were compromised. Although Bill Matthew is no longer with us, his spirit lives on. We are proud to be a voice for those societies left behind, and to champion causes many of you as too divisive to tackle. Our widely respected opinion writers have never shied away from difficult subjects. As with Mr. Ed, the more important the topic, the more committed we are speaking out. But the greatest legacy Ed left the Cat Times was a commitment to finding and reporting the unvarnished truth. We salute our exceptional staff of innovative, enterprising reporters, dedicated truth tellers committed to smart, fair, and thorough investigative reporting. No matter the topic, the audience, or the challenges they face in capturing and disseminating truth. A team of exceptional professionals with only one agenda: excellence. Although our commitment to journalism is decidedly old school, our approach to media is anything but. We work hard to be at the forefront of innovation, embrace the interactive, real-time benefits of the latest channels, delivering insights our readers depend on. Last, but certainly not least, is the Cap Times commitment to philanthropy. The Interview Foundation has given more than $56 million to the people and causes Mr. Interview supported throughout his life. The foundation has made a critical difference to the people whose stories may otherwise have gone untold. Helped ensure that some of Madison's most enduring landmarks are all they are today. William T. Eddy started the Cat Times with the radical notion that he could make Madison and Wisconsin a better place by letting people have the truth and the freedom to discuss it. 100 years later, that vision is as relevant as ever. And the Cat Times remains, as always, Madison as he gets.
Okay. It's aged pretty well over the last 9 years or so. I got a couple things on there. We've now, proud of the Ebbing Foundation, we've now given more than $75 million back to the community at a pace of slightly more than $2 million a year. It's a source of great pride for those of us on the board. A lot of the causes that I think a lot of people in this room are hold dearly and support. And it's really a fun thing to be part of. What people don't understand, we talk about difficult economics, is that when Mr. Evie died in 1970, he and Zilla, his spouse, died without children. And you can imagine a day when the newspaper industry would be here in this 2026. So he created the Evie Foundation. And that's a completely different allotment of money that we can give to charities, nonprofits of various kinds. We also have the Kids Fund, and those are smaller grants, but that's all. We're not getting money much from the community. That's just our money we're getting. That's a source of great pride for me. A summary thing I'd say is in my 50 years, pretty much in the business, most of it in Madison, I've been at the center of the peacetime newspaper industry and now the wartime newspaper industry. It's remarkably different these days. Nick mentioned some of my background. I grew up as a baby boomer in a working class neighborhood in Rockford, about 60 miles south of here. Everybody's parents were, or everybody's father fought in World War II, it seemed like, and been the heart of the baby boom. I fell in love with newspaper, and as a high school student, went to Drake, worked at the Des Moines Register when the Sunday circulation was a half a million. Imagine wow. Half a million newspapers across Iowa. I moved to Washington, D.C., arrived there the same month that Richard Nixon flew away from the Ellipse. August of 1974. It was fascinating to be in Washington during that period.
being in Washington, we have all kinds of fascinating visitors, speakers. I attended the live trial in person a couple times. There was a guy at American University who started their broadcast program there. His name was Ed Bliss. He was one of Edward R. Murrow's boys, one of his original boys, incredibly. And he was Walter Cronkite's first managing editor on the CBS Evening News. And in fact, handed him the note that JFK died on November 22nd, 1963. And so that really kind of opened my world to thinking differently about journalism. I had great teachers there. I took a brief stop. My first reporting job was as the political reporter for the biggest paper. This is what you really call being a big fish in a small pond in South Dakota, in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And I got to know George McGovern pretty well. What a gentle, fatherly figure he was. He's also close to the Capital Times, and I reconnected with him shortly before his death. And I don't know, probably some of you in this room know that his daughter, Teresa, died in Madison of alcohol and mental health issues and treatment centers here named for her. But he was an incredible guy. I also spent some time in South Dakota one-on-one with Jimmy and Rosalind Carter because it was a South Dakota primary, and I was the biggest political reporter, most important political reporter in that state. And both of them were incredibly kind and earnest people. Just looking at some the political surround today, it really is unrecognizable. Anyway, in 1978, my wife Larry and I moved here, and I became a reporter, as Nick said, for the Wisconsin State Journal. I moved through seven different jobs in the State Journal. I came in as county government, called City Hall, the legislature, then I was the top political reporter, the Sunday editor, eventually became an assistant managing editor. When I first got here, I was covering our hippie mayor, Paul Soglin. Paul still has me on speed dial. I call pretty regularly, as I do former Mayor Cieslewicz and Sensenbrenner. That's one thing about being in the media here for as long as I have. I think I looked it up once, and I think I've known every U.S. senator from the state back to McCarthy. So I'm not Dave's grateful, who was my colleague who was hired by the TW in 1962, but I'm closing in I bet a lot of you remember some of the biggest stories there. I was in the State Journal, the Barnwell tornado in 84, 9 people were killed. In 88, I managed the coverage of the shooting rampage at the city county building that killed two by a troubled young man named Aaron Lind. And I was thinking about that recently, thinking how shocking that was then. And now the thought of gun violence is unfortunately not as shocking. It is shocking, but in a different way. I like to tell this anecdote. In 2000, I oversaw what we thought was a big investigator report known as the shoebox scandal that Wisconsin athletes were taking improper discounts on shoes, resulted in NCAA sanctions and messages to me saying, why don't you rename the paper the Michigan State Journal because you're helping. But I think how silly that seems now, this era of name, image, and likeness and famous just shows how long I've been around. Anyway, as Nick mentioned, in 2001, I went over and became vice president of the Madison Newspapers, which is, I'll explain, is the joint organization. And I oversaw circulation, production, the internet department, such as Wesleyan. Human resources, marketing, and niche publications. At that point, that was an organization of about 550 people. It's a fraction of that now. In 2006, I was asked to come by the Cap Times board to join the Capital Times and lead into the turbulent waters ahead. John and I will talk when he gets here in depth about the Cap Times, so I kind of changed my order here so we can talk about that. But let me talk about the business of this title like journalism, the business of newspapers. And there isn't a lot of good news in it, but there's some things you may not have realized or thought about. So I'll just dive in. Before the internet, we were fat and happy. We were a business that not only have high margins, we have high revenue, making a large revenues, and most newspapers were really profitable. Advertisers needed us because there weren't a lot of options for reaching mass audiences other than the newspapers. The first casualty of this new era was our classified advertising. Those classified ads where you'd sell your Chevy or try to hire someone were enormously profitable because they were just these tiny little ads, but we were able to charge a lot for them. And then came Craigslist, which was a shot across the bow of a free alternative to that. The next major casualty was what we call display ads, which are the ads for department stores or groceries or whatever that appear throughout the newspaper. And then we had a fast decline in what we call the preprint business. You'll probably all remember when newspapers were a lot bigger and thicker, and the preprints were those inserts that for Beet Farm or wherever. And I can recall when I was vice president, we'd have two jackets are the things that you put the preprints in, and there's these machines that put these preprints in. And we'd have to have two jackets of preprints for Thanksgiving Day because those papers were so wonderfully profitable for us and filled with all the holiday ads before the internet. Anyway, while this was all happening, people found their way to news and information, accurate or otherwise, via the internet. Our circulation fell. And there's an old adage, excuse my French here, but you don't want to get in a pissing match with somebody who buys his ink by the barrel or his paper by the box barrel. And that used to be true, but that's not true. Which brings me to what I think, this is my view, one of the biggest mistakes we made as an industry was undercharging for our product. And you're going to go, really? And I look at what we're charging these days. But in 1974, to my apartment in Alexandria, Virginia, I think the Washington Post delivered 7 days a week to my apartment door for $5 a month. When I became vice president and got familiar with all the economics, that didn't even cover the ink and paper. The game in the newspaper business was always penetration. In the 1950s and 60s, the daily newspaper penetration exceeded 100%, which meant for every household that got no newspaper, there was more than that who got more than one. Mm-hmm. So the newspaper penetration was like 110%. It was just remarkable. I recall the day that I was managing the director of circulation at the newspaper company, we were much more focused on what we call units rather than revenue. Because if we could be everywhere in front of everybody, that allowed us to drive revenue different ways. So people got accustomed to not, you know, they're willing to pay X or Y for Spectrum or DirecTV or Netflix or whatever, and get kind of used to it. Not to say that some of the behaviors haven't been aggressive on pricing, but, journalism, professional journalism is expensive to produce, and so people kind of recoil from it today and also think they can get some semblance of news elsewhere, good enough elsewhere on the internet, even if it's not particularly professional. We all know younger people. When's the last time you saw a young person, reading a print daily newspaper? We have success with our tabloid. Our weekly tabloid has a high pickup rate, and we're in a lot of urban coffee shops on campus, and it does get picked up, but you don't see the younger people reading a paper like it used to. Social platforms also have been a problem in that they drive more traffic, Google and Facebook, to get up to our content, that they suck up the advertising revenue, much of their advertising revenue that should go to the creators of the content. They're just intermediaries. So where does that put us today looking at it? The top of the industry is the New York Times. And the Times is unique. It's not only indispensable for an elite audience. Hello, John.
Sorry, I'm late.
Right,
yeah, you're just perfect. Well, I'll bring you up when I finish some of this. So the New York Times, is you, they have, I looked it up, they have 12 million subscribers, 11 million of whom are digital only. One of the reasons that the New York Times has prospered in this year is they diversified. So they have a cooking arm, they have games, they have The Athletic, which is a sports site they acquired, and The Wirecutter, which is sort of a version of Consumer Reporter. And, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't then pivot to the Washington Post, which did quite well in the early years of Jeff Bezos' ownership. John will remember we had Marty Baron, the then editor, Pulitzer Prize winning editor of the Washington Post, to our first Idea Fest. And he was incredibly impressive. We have had a lot of Washington Post folks to Idea Fest over the years. But there was a tremendous interest in reading about that during Trump's first term. The Post circulation skyrocketed. And then it fell during the Biden years. And then, of course, we all know that Bezos decided he needed to curry favor with Trump and drove a lot of folks away, starting with not endorsing Kamala Harris, when the editorial that he'd written, and this last week laying off 300 journalists, and it's just a mess. My John's and my friend David Marinus, whose father was editor of the Cap Times, who grew up not to Madison West here, who's a mainstay of Idea Fest, used the F word last week to describe in the New Yorker how much Jeff Bezos cares about journalists, not giving a F. we can talk more about that as we get to the Q&A section. We can talk more about that. Smaller daily newspapers than those national Goliaths are continue to try to replace print revenue with digital revenue, but neither readers nor advertisers are willing to pay as much. And it's a fight as print revenues decline, try to build digital revenues. One technique, and I'm pretty far into the business side of things now as publisher, is to try to sell advertisers on the notion of us being an agency for them. So we can sell them exposure through our products. Sorry, John, products, you know. through our products, but we can also sell radio, TV, billboards, anything, trying to be in that position to try to fortify our revenues. That was some success. The long-term future of the State Journal and other chain daily newspapers appears to be people's willingness to pay for content. I haven't talked at all yet about nonprofit models. Tom Wiley, a friend of mine, it was three or four or five years ago, was publisher of the State Journal. And he promised me he's buying property on Lake Caganza. He's going to be here a long time, so I introduced him to Judy Faulkner and other people. Like, he's always going to be here. And then Warren Buffett sold the Buffalo News to Lee Enterprises, and they tapped Tom on the shoulder and went off to Buffalo. And last year he left Buffalo to become the CEO of the National Trust for Local News, which is a long-winded way of saying that's a model for nonprofit news. They acquire small newspapers and aren't so focused on large margins. So there is some promise in nonprofit, but I'm not talking about that primarily tonight. Let me turn to Madison. John, you want to come up and join?
Sure.
Point.
He's
young and spry. If you want to stand.
I'm not that young. Hey, bring yourself a chair. I'm Pete. I think
So anyway, in 2008, John was involved in this, but I was sort of in the forefront of the controversial decision to cease afternoon print printing. And it was early. We were early in the process, early in what would become a wave. So early that I got interviewed by the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, even Der Spiegel, a German magazine, interviewed me about this controversial decision. Would have happened later anyway. Two or three years ago, I split my job, so I'm no longer editor of the Capital Times, which is, if you think about it, you can't really be publisher and have these business relationships and still have the kind of separation you need to be an editor. Hired a guy named Mark Trinan, who'd been the top editor at Green Bay, the Press Gazette, and Mark's done a great job and hired some really good people. So let me go deeper into Madison, and Jeff can jump in at any point here. But the State Journal was founded in 1839, as the Madison Express, the Capital Times, famously in 1917, when Anevi left the State Journal, outraged by the State Journal's position on how it came World War One. But people don't understand it really very well. Madison Newspapers, which we kind of call ourselves Madison Media Partners, is co-owned by the Capital Times Company, where I'm now chairing the board of directors, and Lee Enterprises. So the Madison Newspapers is co-owned. It doesn't dictate to us. It doesn't control us at all. It's just something we have 50-50 say in. So this was created in 1948 when the State Journal Cat Times, vigorous competitors, vigorous competitors, formed Madison Newspapers to gain business efficiencies, sharing editorial functions, crucially, sharing profits. John knows this story better than I, having written a book, but what you wanted in that era was the afternoon market, people getting out of the factories, coming home. And so he bargained to get the afternoon and gave the State Journal morning and Sunday, which turned out to be suboptimal.
Madison became less of a day of the mixed town. I don't know how many of you are from Madison?
Born in Worcester.
What?
Yeah.
I was 42 years ago.
Yeah.
No. Not that there's anything with Madison for us because you're here, but the reality is that until about 1967 probably, when New Zealand started to really build up the universities, Madison was well divided between a working class east side and factories. It smelled, you know what I mean? If you drive through Gary, Indiana, it smells no worse than the east side of Madison did when Oscar Myers was in full production, right? So that was the east side, working class, unionized, immigrant. West side was,
university.
Yeah, it was people who wore suits, and, you know, like, what did they... At the old line, those people who showered before they went to work. East side showered when he came home. And each side had a paper. And it's true to this. And the State Journal is much more for the west side. Cap Times is much more for the east side. My grandmother and O'Hara Place got both. And a lot of people did. That was a very, very healthy thing. And but that was the dynamic of it. That we had different newspapers and they had different purposes. And to Evue's view, we believe that the working class was absolutely as smart as anybody at the university. In fact, Evue would argue probably a little bit smart. And he just believed that they didn't have breaks in life that got them to a university, right? And so he gave them a paper that spoke to them as intelligently, sometimes more intelligently, than the other paper account, right? And believed that would work just fine. And it did, the bottom line reality does. And so there was this merge, you know, what we talk about here, but putting these two together. But the thing to understand about it was Evue's loyalty to the basic idea of being a paper for the great mass of people, the great working class, prevented him from seeing the future, right? And so at that point, he made the bet that he would stay with the working class, right? He would stay with that. And remember, we also had Franklin Wright writing a weekly column for us. and Max and everybody, you know, I mean, basically every intellectual in town was associated with the Cap Times. But that didn't detract from our audience being less. The business people, the elites, they were the speaker. So you put it together, right? And then times changed. We didn't have the Sunday. Sunday became the incredibly powerful institution. What was the highest circulation for the State Journal?
175,000.
Sunday, 175,000.
Yes, Sunday, 175,000.
You're well aware of it. You would claim that you gave a few papers away, but the Cap Times would never do that, right? And we kept relatively even on the morning afternoon for a long time.
Oh, you're ahead.
Kind of 50s. 50s for sure. And then, but the afternoon started to tick down. Sunday started to become a much more dominant reality, packed with all those coupons and everything. And so that became the reality, right? That we couldn't, we in the afternoon got down to about, was it 17,000?
17,000.
Yeah, so we got down to 17,000 versus 170,000. I'm not a good man, but that seems like about 110. And so choices had to be made. And the funny thing about it was, just Debbie would have loved this. He would have just, this would have, he would have had the biggest smile in the world on his face, because all the smart people at Lee Enterprises and the Iowa newspaper that they publish, all the State Journal folks, they, you know, they had all their things going for them. They tried civic journalism, which was neither civic nor journalism, and all these different gimmicks and things like that. It was the Cap Times that figured out the future, right? And ceased to print on a daily basis, which I hate, I despise. I wish the Cap Times came out in print every day. And you know, I literally go once a year to my grandmother's grave out in Monona and apologize. and then twice a year to Evan's grave. But when we ceased the print on most days and then went to the once a week edition, we embraced reality and the future. And the interesting thing about it is, I will tell you, I will suggest to you, and I know that our friends at State Journal, what's their circulation now?
Not good.
Yeah. It's, you know, let's just say they're competing now with the old Cap Times circulation.
Yeah, the old numbers.
Yeah. And we're read by more people. Because that free weekly that goes out, I see the stats go down, and they, you know, all over, right? People grab it. I'm not naive. I don't think that they, you know, they have to have something to take to the bathroom or with their coffee or whatever. But the fact is that we are, unfortunately, where the future is. State Journal clinging to the past. This is not to beat up on them because they have wonderful people that work there. And I hope they survive because I don't want to see any newspaper go down. But where the Cap Times is now is where a newspaper is going to have to be going forward. Because I still want the print paper. My daughter, who's 22, doesn't read anything in print except the books they make her buy at the university. You know what I mean? But you understand? She started to read books a little bit now, but that makes her weird. This is something we need to understand. We have generation rising, and AI and everything that's coming, which we should talk about in a couple of minutes. AI is making it worse. And I say worse. I'm not casual about this. Where we are headed is a place where we will be digitally inclined, and yet where we are inclined for it will not be reliable. Mm-hmm. And so we're in a very difficult place. Future journalism is not easy. It's complex. Bob Chesney and I wrote a pile of books about it. And you know, we kept trying to warn them, but they didn't listen. And so now we're at this place where I will tell you that I think the Cap Times will be the last paper standing in America. Mm-hmm. And you think that's just a parade or something like that? I think there's a very good chance. I don't mean that really, because there's going to be a lot of other newspapers, and there is a future for a newspaper. But we'll make it through.
and we'll make it through because of the decisions, that very controversial decision some decades ago to cease a lot of the print and to go to once a week.
Thanks, John. I'm going to bring my part of this in for a landing, and then we can have a kind of a conversation and go forward. You know, there's some good news for Madison, I think, in that if you look at the two newsrooms, seldom or almost nowhere do you find two newsrooms in a city our size as professional and well run as these are. And so you still have combined, you have more journalists than you do in a lot of bigger cities.
Cities like Cleveland.
Yeah.
Which don't have as many as we have here.
Yeah. So I'm going to tell you just a couple of minutes about our strategic plan. So journalistically, the State Journal is doing what it's always done, which is be a paper, right? Which is cover everything of interest to everyone, fresh sports and so forth. A couple of years ago, we decided at the Capital Times to do a strategic plan to position us for the future. So frankly, I can turn my attention to the financial side of what's happening with the partnership and so forth and get kind of everything in order. John's been an important part of that. We hired a guy named Nick O'Malley, who headed the Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy at the Kennedy Harvard's Kennedy School. He's also deputy publisher of the LA Times. And he came into town, talked to a lot of people in town, talked to the staff, looked at the national terrain. That's what I wanted, to get outside of our bubble here in Madison, look at the national terrain. And we're in the process of implementing that strategic plan now. We decided we couldn't be everything to everybody. I had this in a column recently, but we're really focused on five pillars of our coverage. And they are a changing city. City and county are evolving with emphasis on development, planning, and transportation. Our education system, we have two reporters focused on kindergarten through high school and on higher education and on the achievement gap and so forth. Our economy and workplace issues. I don't know what the exact percentage is, but there's just an incredible percentage of employment in Wayne County connected to healthcare. Epic is with its 13,000, is a big part of that, but it's something I think is undercovered. Our local politics and government, which is the mainstay of the Capital Times, and our cultural scene. We have Lindsay Christians, and we're very, very strong in that area. And I'll continue to maintain we're the traditional mainstream media that pays the most attention to racial and social justice issues, not only in our opinions, but in our story of science. We're also hiring an opinion editor to join Dave Zweifel and I write a column, and we had an interview today with him personally. We decided through this process we really need to reach a new Madison. That I've talked about this to folks from time to time. It seemed like before the pandemic, and I was editor and not publisher, I knew pretty much all the local decision, pretty most of the local decision makers. John still does. John networks a lot more than I do. But that somehow out of the pandemic, that ceased to be the case. And there's just a need for more really well-informed, careful listening, granular opinion journalism in Madison about what's going on in the city and so forth. We're interviewing for that position right now. We're really excited about it. As has come up in this discussion, we don't have a paywall. Our model is built on paid voluntary membership. We have 200,000 some members making donations, advertising, of course, and event revenue. Our goal is always through the strategic plan to make our members feel a special kinship to us. And we think the live events is an important part of that. 3 years ago, we started a business, which is a little bit out of character for us, but we thought it was an opportunity, a business event in which a CEO from around the state comes and talks to a group at the Edgewater about Power Hour, where business leaders speak. And the most recent one was, I forget her first name, Tish Yancey. The president of American Family Insurance, fascinating, Talisa Yancey,
African-American woman, wonderful stories outside of Chicago. Great story. Anyway, that's been good. We did cooking with the Cap Times, which is a fun event and engages our people. Our marquee event, of course, is Cap Times Idea Fest. John's a crucial part of it. Thank you. We'll be presenting our 10th this 10th annual event this September. Starts September 20th at the Memorial Union. It's become big and popular. I don't know what I've forgotten already if I mentioned Elliot Marinus tonight, but Elliot, I'm told, as Weeful said today, was a member of this organization half a century
ago. Any of you remember? This is, oh, we got a nod. It's great.
Wow.
So, remarkable guy.
So his son David wrote a book, or many books. Mm-hmm. I watched him post, won two Pulitzers for the Washington Post, and is on his 14th book he's writing now on Jack Johnson, the boxer. His last book was on Jim Thorpe at the Olympian. But David went to Madison West and still summers here and wrote a book about how Cap Times saved his family during the McCarthy era when Elliot was blacklisted.
Yes.
And and David great came worker. Here, and David continued to be very close, communicate with him every day or two as we bring together top flight speakers in the worlds of politics, business, education, the arts, and more. And just I got this two paragraphs of names. I was pitching a very famous national speaker's representative. And it helps to show the people we've had before. I put this together. So we featured Nancy Pelosi, Tim Walz, J.B. Pritzker, Stacey Abrams, Heather Cox Richardson, Doris Ernst Goodwin, Bernie Sanders, Adam Kinzinger, Liz Cheney, Amy Klobuchar, Jamie Raskin, Ron Johnson, an earlier version of David Axelrod, among others. Journalists we've had included included Marty Baron, Post, Bob Woodward, Carl Bernstein, Karen Tumulty, Dan Balls, Carol Lenig, Peter Baker, New York Times, White House Correspondent, Susan Glasser, Eugene Robinson, Judy Woodruff, Al Hunt, George Packer, Jane Mayer, Evan Osnos, Jennifer Rubin, Maureen Dowd, among others. So it's been kind of took off beyond our wildest imagination. This early John has a tremendous national context through his senior leadership role at the nation. Marinus helps us. Ben Wickler, chairman for ex-chairman of the state party, has phenomenal connections. I have some connections. So I'm gonna land my remarks here, and then we can open up and take what you want. There's no missing the point that legacy newspapers are under enormous pressure, particularly if they're stockholder pressure. We do not have that. The Capital Times. Capital Times has no debt and has quite a high level of assets. Part of it comes from FU created the first commercially successful radio station in the state, WIDA. And we always say how he's spinning in his grave with Russian
fairly said.
What did we care? But we sold it, and then in the 60s, maybe, took the money and invested it. And that's a long time ago, a lot of time horizon for investment. So we're in a pretty good position there. Interesting, and maybe in the book. They have read it in the book. I would pitch John's book if you're John and Dave wrote this wonderful book. You don't have with you.
I did. I should write a copy of it. Yeah. Fine holiday read.
Yeah. It's a wonderful Madison Center book in Capital Times. But my understanding is that FU was en route to get a television station.
Yes.
And Joe McCarthy hated it. Stop. Right.
Kind of argues against principles of doing the right thing. But yes, this is the distinction. I can tease a little bit about State Journal. State Journal is a good paper, and I hope you read it. I hope you get good. And it's got a bunch of great people who work for it. Many of whom, I'd love to employ, because they do just a great job. But You should understand in the 1940s, 1950s, this place divided, this whole state divided on a very simple moral level. Are you with Joe McCarthy or are you against him? State your own.
That sounds familiar.
State your own. It's not against the current leadership there, but they endorsed him, right? They backed him. And the voters of Wisconsin backed him twice. So we should, you know, understand that politics and understand that dynamic. Have you, it's fair to say that on most things, Evie didn't care, right? I mean, he didn't care whether it was going to cost of it, didn't care whether there was going to be trouble. He had a firm set of principles, and that set of principles turned against McCarthy, not when McCarthy started doing the Red Scare. The first Cap Times investigative story on McCarthy was in 1944. It was before McCarthy with the U.S. Senator. He was running for stuff, and Cap Times was going after him then. We thought he was a crook. We thought he was evil. We thought he was, you know, a bad player. You know, that he was fraudulent, that he lied, in trouble with his taxes. You know, Joe, hold it, I'm thinking. So familiar. But the bottom line was that deep divide, it did cost the captains. There's no question. It was not, there were no gifts for being right, you know, at the end of it, because institutional power, daily newspapers said that backed McCarthy, they survived. The ones that opposed him and the handful that did, they hopefully survived as well. But, you know, as a country, we tend to put things behind us. Important thing to remember for the moment that we are in, right? This is a reality that we tend to think, oh, we just went through something really bad, let's forget about it. Now, I'm saying, do you remember COVID? Right? It's not disgusting, even though it was this fundamental reality in our lives. And what I will tell you is that the greatest source of pride for the Capital Times is having taken that risk, having done that thing in the 1950s. And I think Evie would have said that without a question. And the interesting thing about Evie is that he refused to let his staff members enter contests for newspaper awards. Right? You couldn't, no matter what you wrote, you couldn't enter contests. The reason was he thought that you'd have to lower yourself to the standards of American journalism. Right? You have to, you know, be in that zone of where newspapers were. And the thing is, Evie started his autobiography with about 30 pages of ripping on pretty much every other page. And except he had a handful of weeklies and things around that he liked. But the weird thing about this is you can dislike it, right? And say, oh, that's a little bit pompous, or that's a little bit this or that. But it was a deeply principled stance. He felt that most media in America bowed to commercial pressure, right? That it was more inclined to align with wealth and power than it was to align with the great mass of people. And he was right. We know that because we've seen it play out in the current moment, right? You know, where we see major TV networks even bowing to Trump. Why do they bow to him? Because they're owned by multinational companies that have other interests, right? So suddenly you've got, you know, worry about that. Why is Bezos where Bezos is at? It's because, you know, he's got so much wealth and power in other places that this little Washington Post, that's just an afterthought, right? If he's got to toss it aside in order to curry favor with wealth and power, he will do that, even one of the wealthiest men in the world. And so if we put this into perspective, and you set a model for journalism that was different than virtually any place else. It was a unique model. Not the only one. He had allies, a handful of people in other papers. St. Louis Post-Dispatch, he loved, was close to. Washington Post for a long time, very close to. But the truth is that he wouldn't let staffers enter contests. So in 1951, John Patrick Hunter, who was, you know, an epic member of the Cap Times. John Patrick Hunter, who got the assignment to work, he was you've been hired late in the game. You know, a lot of other people had been hired before. And he was he had to work on July 4th. So he had to do something on that day to get a story for the pit. So he's sitting around the office, and he said, I'll go down to the square because there's a bunch of people down there for parties and celebrations. And he didn't know what he was going to do. And he says, he's walking out, there was a copy of the Constitution on the wall, right? So John Patrick copied down all sorts of things from the Constitution, and he took a couple lines from the Declaration of Independence, and he put them on, like, typed them up on a petition, and he walked around the square and asked people to sign his petition. And this was in the midst of McCarthyism, when it was at its peak. So he'd go up to people and say, he'd sign this petition. 110 people looked at it and said, nope, not me. Walked away, wouldn't sign it. The 111th, who I believe was an insurance man, said, oh, I'll sign the Bill of Rights, you know, and did. John Patrick wrote this story up. It revolutionized the whole discussion in the country. Harry Truman mentioned it in the White House. It was mentioned on if TV stations talked about it. Other newspapers talked about it because they said, wow, it looks like things could be pretty bad here. We may have let things get a little out of control as regards civil liberties and things of that nature. And if there was ever a story, maybe in history, and I'll give Woodward and Bernstein their due, but if there ever was a story that should have won the Pulitzer Prize, that was probably it. But John Patrick couldn't enter it in the contest because they have this rule. And the bottom line is that's the Cap Times at its best. That's what the Cap Times has been and what it will continue to be, which is a newspaper that is willing to go out and ask that very difficult question and take that difficult stance when other papers don't. The Cap Times was opposed to the Vietnam War when most people didn't even know there was a Vietnam, right? And the Cap Times was opposed to the war in Iraq, the first one and the second one. And we were the newspaper that after 9/11, that horrific, terrible event, said we had to find diplomatic solutions. Let's not get ourselves involved in Afghanistan for 20 years. We're pretty much always right. And we imposed the Patriot Act with Russ Hines, you know, a lot of lonely stands along the way, and civil rights, gay rights, a host of other issues, out ahead of the curve. I mean, one time, one of my favorite things was that when the marriage equality movement started going, right, people started to get very excited about it. You started to see people come on board, support it. Some newspapers started to endorse it. Things like that. And they didn't know if the Cap Times didn't get mentioned much at that point, right? Because Cap Times had come out for it decades before. And that was often the case, that the Cap Times has taken stands on issues long before it became the popular or easy thing to do. And so when we criticize Donald Trump today, we notice that a lot of other institutions are starting to do so as well. And at the end of the day, we may not get the credit for being the first to oppose, but I can tell you that on most issues and most of the things that have come up, we have been. And it isn't because of me, and it isn't because of Paul. It's because of you, now gone since 1970, who's watching over us, going, you got to do the right thing. The guy's got a question.
Yeah. Just to segue on that topic, I've been a longtime observer of what I think of as the local Overton window.
Yeah.
Things that are acceptable to discuss and not. Credit to the Cap Times. Mike Iger wrote an article about Tammy and Judy Faulkner's role in the $38 billion backdoor medical record subsidy. Mm-hmm. And if you track the timing of that, you know, when they were 1,000 people to 13,000, I find it incredibly ironic that federal taxpayer splurge has led to a lot of things you, Paul, have written about on the, you know, transportation changes and density, all this kind of stuff. So that's sort of one thing. And the second thing I want to applaud you about is Danielle and Mark's article on the sexual misconduct, now referred to as misconduct, by the way, by the DPI, not sexual misconduct, on that topic. And I would say, I hope you continue to expand that, because the fact that we now have almost 9,000, 43% of Madison School District 4K to third graders are reading below the 25th percentile nationally. Almost 9,000. That's a disaster. It's all our fault.
Yeah.
But I would argue that you guys should be diving much deeper into that sort of grand industrial complex where the funds come however they come and they drive policy that affects a lot of locals. That's a huge change in my 25 years in Madison. You could see that money just changing everything. And we haven't voted on it. It happened through lobbying. Tammy defends it. No, I think it was wrong.
Let me, this is why we do things like this,
mm-hmm.
right? If a good question is a question that makes the person up front feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
A question that they should say, well, thank you.
Right.
And one of the things about being out in the community and talking to folks is you do hear things that people are upset about. Mm-hmm. And that is always, you know, it's historically what makes any journalism, not just the captains, mm-hmm. any journalism good, is if you hear things and you go and you keep digging into it.
Right.
And what I'll tell you is that in the contemporary moment, I can tell you right now, the university, my family's been going to the university since the 1880s,
mm-hmm.
and my daughter's there now. And there's a whole bunch of things to say that are nice about the university. But they're diving into AI right now.
Totally.
Yeah, look, just diving right in. Without the critical questioning and skepticism that I think they should.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we should be writing about. Data centers and all these things as well. And 10 years ago, Bobby Chesney and I wrote a book about machine learning and all this. And it was clear then where we were going, right? AI could cure your cancer. So give it that. But it's also a giant grift. It's a scheme that's going to take massive amounts of money and put it into the hands of the very wealthiest people and make them wealthier. I mean, this don't miss this point. Elon Musk will become a trillionaire by the end of this year,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah,
and then Bezos and these others will go right into that trillion status. And you have to ask yourself, a technology that's supposed to make your life better somehow makes a smaller number of people dramatically richer, right? Is that really making your life better? Or is it just simply a scheme where they're gonna get more and more power and more control? So there's so many things that we can be looking at right now. University's approach to AI should be a huge investigative and structural.
But in that, that's a great example. In that case, you know, the politicians have given Google, backed by the CIA, by the way. It's Intutel. They funded.
No, too far down.
Yeah. Anyway, but they have the right to scrape everything, right? So the stuff you write is scraped and feeds the AI bots.
Oh yeah.
So that was a political legal thing, and yeah, so it would be better if people got compensated for that work. No question
be
about it.
The concept that it would be better also if you didn't see the natural play out of AI, yeah. which is that it's going to go into nursing homes,
mm-hmm.
right? And you're going to give people a screen, right? Mm-hmm. And you say, this is a great deal. Your mom's here at the nursing home, and she's going to look at this screen every day, and she's mm-hmm. going to have an AI friend.
Oh, totally. It's already, there are dogs already, yeah.
Don't.
Yeah, yeah.
No. Business. And how it will come into healthcare, right? And it'll be, well, if you're wealthy enough, you'll probably be able to have a nurse with a name. And so everything about how we live will be impacted by AI. It's huge. And it's, again, it can cure your cancer. It probably will. The way that the way that it keeps digging and going deeper is that it can get to answers that we haven't been able to get to. That's wonderful. May also provoke a nuclear war. Yes.
This may be more for Paul. I don't know. Should we be concerned about this other Florida billionaire, Hoffman, buying a controlling share in Lee Enterprises? What impact would that have on the State Journal? What impact would that have on the Cap Times?
That's a great question. It's better. 3 or 4 years ago, there was truly a vulture fund trying to acquire Lee, which would have acquired Lee and sold it for parts, mm-hmm. Just milked it for a year or two of profit, so it wanted, pressured us to try to sell our profits to liquidate and so forth. Hoffman, I don't know how much you've read about him. We have a new Ameta guy today who's the new designee to be our leading revenue person. And I'm pretty close. We're close to St. Louis Post-Dispatch publisher and vice president who have responsibility for Madison from the Lee side. I don't know how to read him yet. I was concerned, though, that I saw something about he thinks the Post-Dispatch needs to go further to the right, which is always
isn't that ironic?
Which is always a red flag. And I'll talk to, because I know the publisher is this advertising VP right now. They come to the PDF Fest and they love it, and they're not. But it's not even. It's a centrist newspaper now, and that's the biggest Lee property. So it's way too early to know. He desperately wanted in. Because Lee had such crippling debt from acquisitions of 20 years ago that they basically forced him to let him be chairman of the board. And I just don't think we know yet what exactly he wants. He says things like, gee, I see there are four copy machines in the same office. Couldn't you buy with one? Oh, so, you know, things like that. I'm watching carefully. He bought the Napa, California newspaper from Lee two or three years ago. I saw the term sheet on it. He's run it. Hasn't come in, interfered at all, you know, producers. So, I think there could have been worse outcomes is what I'm saying. But I guess we don't know yet. I'm kind of wondering, Lee has 70-some newspapers. Used to be, when I was young, it was the biggest market was Madison at one point. And then... management got kind of over its skis and decided they was going to buy these bigger properties, including St. Louis, Omaha, when they bought it from Buffett and Buffalo and so forth. So I really don't know where this is going. My point was going to be only two of all of these properties have partners. One is in Tucson, where there's just a kind of a silent partner, in Madison, where you have a 50-50 partner. So they can't do anything with the Cap Times, and they just can't do anything. We own 50% of everything, so it would be a board decision. I just don't know yet whether how long it's going to be before he notices he has a partner like Madison and
Let me ask you just a follow-up then. If he were to, impact the State Journal side, mm-hmm. what kind of repercussions could that have for the Cap Times operations?
Well, if he comes in and cuts staff further and raises prices, and it messes up an already beleaguered business model of profitability. There were when I was in the State Journal, we were kind of the big brother. Now that's not the case at all. And in fact, I'm sure Lee would like to sell us the State Journal if we were of a mind to buy it. Now, I can't imagine why that would be the scenario given the print circulation decline. It's a big question mark right now. But it could have been worse outcomes. I'm forgetting the name of those. You remember the name of the venture capital?
It wasn't Alden.
It was Alden.
About the trip.
They just destroyed them.
Destroyed
these.
This is the one thing. One thing I suggest to you is that there's a lot of people who still live in the fantasy that maybe a rich guy will come along and buy something, mm-hmm. right? And Bezos should cure you of that.
Yeah.
The reality is that there aren't, and I know I've never said this before, there are not enough rich guys, right, to save every paper, who have it as like a vanity project that they want.
Wayne sports team.
Right, exactly.
And even when they do, the LA Times, they take it to the right or
exactly
butcher.
So bottom line is there aren't enough rich guys first, mm-hmm. and when they do come, they turn out to be, it's an odd thing. They're either, you can be a rich guy or a newspaper publisher, they choose to be rich guys. And so at the end of the day, that overwhelms an awful lot of instincts. It's not the solution for journalism.
Right.
The only thing worse than a rich guy would be a venture capital fund. And it happens that at this point, those are the two ones that are playing a lot, right? So am I glad that the State Journal has a rich guy? Yeah, on balance, because it's not a venture capital fund. Do I think that's the way that journalism is going to be saved? Probably not. I'm not inclined in that direction.
Let me take this to a lower level, where I know I follow the railroad industry and a lot of small one-off railroads. You get these conglomerates that buy these up because they can, in fact, save money.
Right.
By putting the business side in the owner, they do actually, well, they're not the rich guys, they're not the big tape,
yeah.
They're little. Mm-hmm. So to what extent is that happening with the potential to at least help save some of the really small, little, tiny newspapers? Is any of that stuff going on?
Well, yeah.
Is there any hope in that?
You mean a consortium, you know?
A consortium.
There's some of that. I had a dinner with a guy who something Fresh River Valley was doing some of that. One of the interesting experiments is a guy I know named Sage Wheel, who followed his, he made about $100 million in California and followed his surgeon wife, UW Hospital here. And he created something called Civic Media. And he's purchased 30 radio stations around the state.
Wow.
And I see him pretty regularly. I wrote a column about him 2 or 3 years ago. His notion is not to run left-wing talk to oppose the right-wing dominance, but to have local stations that are kind of like a weekly newspaper used to be, with the farm report and what the county council did and local ads, which a local community are as good, are as interesting to people as news content, probably. And I had lunch at him for Christmas. We're talking about possible collaborations and things. He sees that as a way then to as an entry into a web version of a newspaper. Instead of coming from print, it's coming from the radio signal to the website. So that's a different kind of model. So there is some of that.
There's some. In Hamburg, Madison newspaper owns a couple of.
Yeah, we all know the publication.
The Middleton Times Tribune and those.
We tried.
Is that ever started? That papers of
record. Yeah, we tried that a long time ago. We started our own series of suburban papers, and it
didn't go that well.
No.
But here's the bottom line: a good local paper is open locally, right? That's just reality,
sir.
And I take that, my whole life. I grew up in a little tiny town, Union Grove, and my grandmother lived in Madison, so I'd come up here, so I've lived in Madison as long as you said. But what I will tell you is that in that little town, they had two local papers owned by two local guys who hated each other. And we don't have two local papers anywhere except here. This is a rare entity. And we're losing them left and right. And the notion of a consortium to save them, while worth exploring, is probably not the answer. The ultimate answer is that the print newspaper, by and large, may disappear. Although the weekly has a potential, if it's of quality, to maybe last longer. And I see the occasional weekly that does. What we've got to figure out is a business model for journalism. It isn't for a paper. It is for a newsroom. The idea that you can save a newsroom with 20 people who go out and, feel a responsibility every day. And remember, the most important purpose of a newspaper is to cover that which is boring, right? Absolutely, right? It's cover that which is interesting. Everybody's, you're going to get that from all sorts of places. A newspaper's job is to find that which most people don't want to cover, right? But yet has profound impact on your lives. And so do you cover the county board? Yes, you should, because that has a profound impact, even though it can, those meetings can go pretty long. And the average person says, you know, I'd much rather be sitting at the Unitarian Meeting House listening to Paul Bama than going to a Canon board meeting. And so the end result is that that newsroom is what sends somebody out and says, you got to cover that thing, or you got to cover this and that. And that's becoming increasingly uncommon. And that's what we want to save. We want to save the newsroom. Because if you save the newsroom and it goes out and covers things, we had a series this year, right? And we've had a couple of series that are incredibly important, but one on schools and on people that get dismissed as teachers. And many of our very liberal friends didn't like it, right? Because it casts aspersions on how the DPI runs some things. But it was important to do. And that's my point, is that wasn't, nobody would have said, oh, wow, you should, you know, that's what I'm thinking about today. It was something that was off the radar, and if you send somebody up to do it, and you give them enough time to do it, they may save a lot of people, life may get a whole lot better. And that's my bottom line. And it's saving newsrooms, developing newsrooms, getting the resources to them. Other countries have different models on this. The most interesting ones are in Scandinavia, where they actually do create models where you can essentially subsidize the press that you want. You, by subscribing to something and getting its circulation up, then gets a broader government support. And yes, effectively. Germany's model is fascinating because they have seven national television networks, but they're run regionally and go national, right? They're public. And the model, there, it's not to say German TV isn't perfect or anything like that, but they wanted to have competing networks that were controlled by, you know, not by big corporations. And it was crazy, the German model, right? So kind of anti-corporate and publicly oriented, was not come up, Germans didn't come up with it. The people who developed it was the American occupying force after World War II. And one of the reasons they worked with very smart Germans to develop it is because they didn't want to see the rise of fascism. And they thought that if you allow media to be controlled, be concentrated control by big economically and politically powerful institutions, you might go back the way you came. And so the weird part about it is we've written, my late colleague Bob McChesney and I wrote a lot of books about this. The United States after World War II developed some of the best media systems in the world. Country with the highest circulation newspapers even now is Japan, right? Mm-hmm. We need to spend some time there as well. And if you go back and look at the history of how the Japanese media system was developed and built out after World War II, the United States was hugely involved in it, right? The weird part was that they didn't let Eisenhower or McCarthy bring the ideas for MacArthur. Bring the ideas back home. So if you want to see a good media system, look where we were in other places. And I'm not, by the way, arguing for the occupation of other countries. Venezuela and the current moment. I'm just telling you that we've had some good ideas. This is not to say these are the ideas that are going to solve our problems. But what it is to say is that there are ideas out there, right? There are creative ways. Paul is in the middle of developing some of the most creative ideas that you have. The membership model, the event model, things like this that draw in revenue and thus sustain the journalism. And so it's happening everywhere. I'm not depressed about the future of journalism. I'm depressed about the past that lingers, right? I want a future for journalism that is about building out those newsrooms in every town and in every place. And it is not something we've got the solution to right now. It is something we're working at. And the fact that this group of people is here, which by the way is a plenty fine group of people to start solving any problem. The fact that this group of people is here tonight, because you're interested in this, you want to talk about this, this is our hope, right? Because if the people want to save journalism, and want to have and know that it relates to democracy, we got a way out of this. We don't know our way yet, but we know it.
So
we're the host of the future one.
That leads right into the question of just membership model, which we're members.
Thank you.
And I kind of wondered from time to time, why are we members of what? And now it's been glad that we got that. But my question is that, are people coming to you? Is that something that might spread? Is it something that might work? It might be scalable? And,
a little more granular. So what we did through this was our consultant thinks that the idea is to develop deep contacts, deep identification with our members. So we were talking before tonight about possibly using the Unitarian Meeting House for more member-only sessions. John with Mark Bolkan, John with Tammy Baldwin,
Had a great event with Feingold.
We did a great full house here with Feingold to make folks feel that the Capital Times, they know us, they see us, they feel more than just the newspaper. But the model we're doing right now, if you haven't looked at it, give it a try. We do a daily newsletter, and Nico says it, our newest version, it's kind of like the newspaper hitting the driveway in the old days. It's carefully written, it's colorful, it's informative, it's different, it's a high effort kind of thing. And we're trying to bring more people into the Cap Times fold that way, get them familiar with our content, and then maybe try us as a member, as a voluntary member without a gun to their head, or anything. Yeah. Just join us and then have opportunities to interact with us. We've got a core of really good new reporters we've added in the last year and a half. We're
doing something that no publisher, editor, American can say.
Very
rare to say we've got a core, we got a bunch of new great reporters.
Yeah,
I shouldn't say none, but that's a very rare thing to be able to say. Mm-hmm. And you're part of what makes that possible.
Yeah, and we really, really do appreciate
the members are really vital, and so are the people that come to IdeaFest. And so are, there's a lot of things that feed into this. So is the person who picks up the weekly paper and makes it something that an advertiser wants to be in, because advertising is still a sustaining reality for a lot of
people.
Press that one a little bit. Is it a model that's being starting to be...
Other places are trying.
Yeah, other places are trying it. Yeah. But there's still mostly paywalls and...
we're just better at it.
I'm trying to think of a way to distance myself. I love writing my column, and I love being at events like this, and I love what comes with the notoriety of being in my position as being able to write. The most important thing that I think I'm doing now are not thinking about tomorrow or next week or next month, but what it's going to look like in 3 to 5 years. And being the person who's dealing with Lee Enterprises and whatever happens there, continue to think about new models. I mentioned... May have been before you got here, may have been after. But yeah, we're interviewing a new additional opinion person. It's somebody's going to be really important for us to connect with your children, our children, our the next generation, so they get to know the Capital Times and get familiar with it. So that's really where my head's at, in terms of going forward with the strategic plan.
So we got a couple more questions here. Why don't we go to you, and then we'll come up this way. You're it. Yes.
That's me. So I was just curious, how many members do you have?
A little over more than 2,000.
Mm-hmm. And what's the sustainment? Are you happy with that? And how are you?
No, we'd like to have a much larger group. And, at some point, we'd like to have what we call FU members who give a higher level, kind of like public television or radio. And we'd like to have far more. But we think we've only been at it a handful of years, and it's voluntary. So we're heartened by the direction of it. But again, it's part of a package of making people feel part of the Cap Times, a kinship with it, going to events, having other sorts of...
It's not, and the thing to understand about it is it's not about making a profit off that, right? Become a member, that helps more journalists to get hired, right? It's a pretty, and more events to be held, more things to be done. It's a pretty cool line. And it's a little bit like public television or because people do understand. Would 2,000 is a very, in the game of this around the country, that's a pretty significant number. That's a, for the size of the community and what you're trying to do. You asked about, you know, what kind of like where you might want to go. I don't need greedy. I wouldn't say maybe 100, 150,000. That would be great. But on the modest circumstance that we're in, doing pretty good. And the more people that become part of that, the better. And the fact of the matter is, that's closer to where the Cap Times historically was. Because, you know, when Ebbe started the Cap Times, right, back in 1917, he was so mad at the State Journal and so mad at the other papers in the state because they were attacking La Follette for his opposition to World War I. World War I is a really bad war, sorry. Mm-hmm. And so he got in his car and he went around the county and he would drive up to farms and he would say to the farmer, Bob La Follette's in trouble. Can you give me $5 to buy a printing press? Right? And, you know, they got a little, gave a piece of paper that some of them still have. It's called stock. It's called stock, but it wasn't really, you know, barely achieved that. But bottom line was, he would come home with his, you know, little bag of money. Eventually they bought a press. And that, you know what I mean? This was an institution that was created by people effectively betting on it. Right, you know, saying I want to be a part of this as a basically a member, a long, long time ago. And the weird thing about it was, this is Ebbe's coolest act, right? This is 1917. Into the 1970s, he had a little rule. If you were one of those people that gave him, you know, a little bit to get it started, right, you got no bit on the front page. And so we were doing barbers and some people who were seamstress down on State Street. She got an open, you know, because as far as Ebbe was concerned, those were really important people.
Thanks.
So, and I don't know if we're going to promise that for the.
Yeah. Let me just say that we usually, our format is usually to end by 9 o'clock.
Oh.
But we will, if you can stay it's a little bit beyond that.
We this woman.
We can have a couple more questions. Okay, great.
Then we're out of here. Okay. Maybe plus this space. Yes.
So you've made the point, really, by talking about the idiosyncrasies of the heritage of the Capital Times, which is so spectacular, so special, so the genealogy of this paper is so particular that somebody of my persuasion who happens to live on the East Side, who happens to have a 42-year-old autistic daughter who delivered until the last day half a round of the Cap Times and could not believe that it stopped publishing, but would climb over embankments of snow and ice when her job coach wouldn't come with her because people needed their information and needed those papers. And the job coach would be at the high school staying warm, and my daughter, I mean, how hard to reproduce is that other places? How could we not want to be part of a story like that? Because by being a member, you are joining a story that goes all the way back to somebody like Ebbe. I mean, that's so remarkable.
Well, and thank you for that invitation. Kristen, well, thank you for that. And I say it strongly because I really wish that we still had, you know, paper boys and paper girls and that whole thing. And I'm warned that that isn't something that we do.
Yeah.
Because that would be part of the way a lot of kids learned about, making a living. And it was a very special thing.
Many papers with a membership model don't have that spectacular story that makes you want to be a member, right? I mean, all of us are going to become members. There's no question. But one idea is you're going to become a member because A, the speaker, and B, the speakers are fabulous. And it's, anyway.
You're very, you're super blind.
No, you're super right,
of course. But the challenge of this is, can you recreate it everywhere? Maybe, maybe not. And history is hard to recreate. All of these things. And could you create it for a principled conservative newspaper? I say yes.
I think so.
Yes, I would think that is great.
Why not?
As long as the information is real.
It's accurate and true and there's some sense.
It's the product. Information that's real.
And so here's the interesting twist to this. In the AI moment, the great question that we'll have is there a desperation for authenticity, right? Now, we haven't gotten there yet. We wish we were there. But is there a desperation for authenticity? If there is, that might well be the point. I'm not guaranteeing. That might well be the point where we recreate many of the, you know what I mean, the principal model of actually trying to get people information with a set of informed opinions. And you come to that because you are so horrified by everything around you. You know what I mean? So many fakes and all this. You saw the assistant DA down in Kenosha this week that got in trouble because submitted some major legal brief, some brief in a trial that was full of AI.
Yeah.
And the judge threw out all the charges. Just said, I'm sorry, that's it. Came to me with this AI stuff. And I'm just not going to, we're not going to go forward with this.
It's a great story.
What's that?
It's like fairly important.
A little bit.
Every person's going to have to figure out their own way to get their information or test its reality.
I think Mr. Bonnie is going to say it. Thank you for that, for reading the book. And but this is the bottom line is we may come to that point where the desire for authenticity takes us into that next stage. Can we recreate, can we give every institution history? No, you can't. Can you start making history? Yes, you can. And so I think the Trump era the same way, right? You know, you look at your moments that you're in and you ask yourself, are these all bad or are there opportunities that come of this? I'd say the moment right now, all bad. But ultimately opportunities may come. And this is the critical thing about journalism. Journalism in America has evolved and changed 100 times, you know, and it's been very, very different. It will evolve and change. If we're lucky, it will evolve and change another 100 times. And Cap Times is a part of that arc of history. We are so lucky to be stewards of that arc, right? And I can just tell you that I once wrote an article for a journal about editorial page editors and stuff like that. And everybody's writing about, you know, how you form your opinions. And the title of my article, that is slightly different, was basically, you know, our publisher rules from the grave. And it was about that view. It was just saying that we've got a set of principles that we were founded on. And at our best, we will stick to them, not clawing backwards to just be, you know, hang on to something from the past. But it's those principles themselves that tell you to go forward, but rooted in a certain set of ideas about how you do a newsroom, how you do a newspaper, where you go on this. It is very challenging. But I'll tell you, tonight you've listened to a guy who has committed himself to the hard part. Because the hard part is not going out and writing an opinion, right? The hard part is figuring out how to keep that going, keep that machine running. And so
I'll tell one last anecdote. It's a small anecdote thanks to the kinds of things John was just saying. But, you know, I hear a lot about the State Journal. I calls get to my phone from very frustrated people who can't get in the building to talk about circulation and so forth. This is sort of a sort of symbolizes the way that the Capital Times works. We don't sell very many mail. So we don't have very many mail subscribers to our weekly tabloid.
we do it as a favor, we don't do it really for revenue. But a woman called and she was somewhat confused and had really missed her last two Capital Times. And I sent it over to a guy named Mike Cornerman, who joined us 5 or 6, 7 years ago. I've known him a long time. He's the chief revenue officer of the Capital Times. I sent her the note over to, could you follow up with her? She calls me the next day and said, Mike had delivered the last two editions to her house and included a Capital Times pad and some pens. that's the Capital Times.
Totally.
Capital Times has.
Totally.
When I think about Sarah.
Can't do better than that.
And John used the phrase, we've got to be lucky. We have been very lucky.
Yeah. Oh,
thank you.
Thanks. If we have a little bit more time and spend it, that's fine. There's everyone up here.
Oh, hey,
thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, it's really-